Hi, Rodrigo.
Hello, Kevin. How's it going?
Excellent, and we are good to go.
Fantastic.
All right. So let's start with your year of graduation, including if you finished up coursework, spring, summer, fall, and your major or majors.
Awesome. Yeah, so I graduated in May of 2017, but I stayed until the end of the summer semester, so early September, finishing up a couple classes. Yeah, and I did do dual major. I was MP&E and performance.
Oh wow, that's not for a faint of heart.
Yeah, that was an interesting combination. Even being a student, it was hard to fully commit in the way that either one of those majors require one to do. So it was a challenge.
I feel like a lot of people with wanting to do the two of them would just declare themselves pro music and be done with it.
Yeah.
Awesome. What was your principal instrument?
I did study guitar, and I'm still a guitarist to date. I did study with a couple different professors, so that was pretty nice.
Awesome. All right. We will get to your history later, but for now, tell us about your current job. Where do you work? What do you do?
Awesome. Yeah, so I am currently a software developer at an insurance company based in Rhode Island called Falvey Insurance Group. It is a smallish company. It's growing pretty fast. And my job.
How many employees would you say?
Currently 220.
Okay.
And it'll probably be around 250 by the end of the year.
Sure. And you said that you're a computer programmer with them. There are some companies where most of the people working there are computer programmers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are others. My wife is a software quality assurance engineer at Boston University. And needless to say, programmers and quality engineers are far from the majority of people at Boston University.
Right.
So, like, how many programmers are there at this 200-something person?
Currently the entire IT department is around 35 to 40 people, I would guess. Roughly 25% of the company is in some capacity related to our development.
Oh, more than I'd have thought.
Yeah.
Cool. And what's your exact job title?
Yeah, I'm a platform developer too. So software developers do many different things.
One, two, three, four, like which often correspond to like junior, standard, senior, principal.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I'm a platform developer too. So it means I'm one step after or one step past junior. And platform just means that my team deals with developing the tools that are the primary tools in our insurance platform, essentially.
So these are tools that are used internally as opposed to being sold elsewhere.
Usually, yes, in a platform team. However, one of the particularities of my job is that our tools are both used internally and externally.
Oh.
But the external part is on a very limited basis, sort of like a business to business or other brokers or other underwriters that are not directly employed by our company, but conduct business with our company also use our systems.
I see. They use your systems when they're using your insurance products, in other words.
Correct. And then we also have a large part of our business is through APIs, so just through back-end services that
What's an API?
An API is an application program interface.
Got it.
So you don't really touch it, but anytime that, for example, Tom's Shoes is a big client of ours. Anytime you purchase a pair of Tom's shoes, if you choose to have shipping insurance, that basically sends a request to one of our servers to create a policy for the shipment of those shoes.
Right. That certainly sounds like something that needs to be automated, because it's not worth too much money. You know, I'd say, like, you wouldn't want to pay a human whatever per hour to write an insurance policy for shipping a pair of shoes.
Correct. Yeah. So basically, one of the parts of our system that is not internal is the integration of those services onto whichever platform you use to sell products, either retail, wholesale, or whatever you do with your business.
Gotcha. Cool. And how big's your team?
My team is exactly 4 people. We have one senior developer that is basically our coordinator, and 3 developers that are pretty much the same level as I am. I like that size. It allows us to be very connected, collaborate a lot, and move pretty fast.
Interestingly, because many types of software, a team is developers, but there'll also be like a project manager and a couple quality assurance engineers and maybe someone else. But sounds like you're an all developer team.
Yeah, we are an all developer team. There is the way our organization is set up is a little different. So we do have a project manager. We also have a product manager. We have a requirements engineering team, and we also have a QA team. And they are, I guess, subdivided into also smaller units that get handed sort of chunks of our work to get tested.
Sure. Got it. And you all do waterfall or agile?
We work agile currently.
Cool. That's a sprint, couple weeks or so. Mm-hmm. You plan what you're going to do. You do it. On to the next.
And then we do a retrospect to see how things went, basically.
Gotcha. About how many hours a week do you work on average?
I will say that I work a very standard American work week. I have a 9-to-5, and it's quite literally cut and dry 9-to-5. However, the developers are expected to only have around of 6 hours of development per day. So, you know, that amounts to 5 times 6 is 36. So
5 times 6 is 30.
Oh, my bad.
Sorry, I teach math.
Musician, quick math, broken, right? That's exactly the number. We do 30 hours a week of actual development. And, you know, that varies greatly depending on if the time that a task was estimated to take was shorter or longer, if there were complications. Sometimes we get bugs that come in that are a priority, and we do have to handle them immediately. So there is, like, some give or take to those active 30 hours worth of code, so to speak.
Got it. So it's like, if you're averaging 6 hours a day writing code, I assume the other two is meetings?
Meetings, documentation. You know, code needs to get very accurately and methodically documented. Testing, you know, clicking on a ticket and marking it to get under review, submitting a pull request, like all of the other work management sort of tedium that comes along with the meat and potatoes.
Got it. Okay, like, in some way you mentioned other people would count as part of programming.
Some people would, especially the testing part. We have, interestingly enough, we have a dedicated task or ticket every week to write tests for the code that we've built. So that is a separate endeavor in and of itself that we also take care of.
Gotcha. Another question I have here for you is, to qualify for these interviews, one of the criteria you had to hit is that you enjoy what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it about software engineering that you enjoy?
Yeah, that I knew that question was coming, and I've been trying to put it in a very succinct way. Believe it or not, and this comes and goes to different people, I've met a lot of musicians that are now software engineers, and part of my decision-making process was to conduct a series of more informal interview with people that used to be musicians that are now software engineers, and that there is a lot of similarities. There are a lot of similarities between developing software and being a musician, and sort of like the mental space that you have to be to be good at it and to actually write code that works. Obviously, it's very different to practice a saxophone or practice on a guitar for countless hours a day. But when you're in the flow state, when you're in that mental state of actually getting the work done, the cognitive process that's going on is, to me at least, indistinguishable.
Interesting. So, like that process of what, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you're saying just like creating something, or?
Yeah, it's definitely a process of creating something. And I've always, even as a musician, been very analytical about my process. When I was full-time musician, I worked a lot as a producer and also as a guitarist. And my process was always very methodical, very structured. And that translated very well into software development. There's, you kind of have to think of the code that you're going to write before you even start writing it. And it has to make sense logically before you even execute it.
Sure.
And that's kind of, you know, practicing, to play over Misty or to play over Donnelly or whatever changes you're trying to play on. You kind of have to understand what you need to be prepared for, know all your different chord voicings, inversions, chord scales, arpeggios. You need to have that, and then you assemble it. And that's very similar.
Gotcha. All right, very cool. Oh, yeah, it's funny when you talk about that. My father was in software.
Oh, yeah?
He was an entrepreneur, but, you know, his company, I think, topped out about 150 employees.
Okay.
It ended up like 20-something years ago, it merged with another company, so I promise you've never heard of it.
Wow. But that was the golden age of software, I would say.
Yeah, and you know, one thing he said, and I always say this to my students, is he talked about all the different stages in the software, right? Where, yeah, first you think about what it is you're going to do, then you sort of, it gets mapped out as to how the piece going to fit together, then you code it, right? Then you test it. And his rule is always, every time you go up another level, an error becomes 10 times as expensive to fix.
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to do those early stages really, really well.
Correct, yeah. And that's kind of like the concrete part of it, but I think on a more emotional part of the whole thing, if you will, is the way that I feel when I am working on software and writing code feels a lot like the really amazing moments that I felt when I was playing music. So at least for me, it makes sense.
Awesome. Cool. Well, let's take it back now to 2017.
Yeah.
As you're finishing up Berkeley. Although, if you feel this story has a logical earlier starting point, we can take it back before 2017.
Got it.
Otherwise, you know, you're probably not thinking software engineer. Maybe you were. But put us in your headspace as, you know, Berkeley was wrapping up. And we'll take it one step at a time from there to where you are now, both in terms of what you were doing for work, but also in terms of where you were at mentally in terms of your career.
Hmm. that makes a lot of sense. I will say, I, even from before Berkeley, given that you did open that door, Berkeley was kind of a very early or very young decision that I made. I got a scholarship when I was in around 15 years old. And that basically told me that I was good enough for music, which is definitely not a good way to look at it. But
sorry, was the scholarship to like the 5-week program or?
Yeah. I got a full ride for the 5-week. And then during the 5-week, I was in the rock workshop, right the first year that Professor Marty Walsh was in charge of it. Mm-hmm. And then I eventually, you know, that started a process of me getting accepted into the university. I then had some scholarship to attend, which, you know, it opened the door for me to consider music professionally. But I come from a hybrid family. My mom is an artist, a visual artist, and an academic of the arts. And sort of like my paternal side is very much towards the engineering side. So I always had that duality in me, and I knew that at some point in my life I would want to pursue other interests. I just didn't know when, right? So then fast forward to 2017 when I was just graduating from Berkeley. You know, it's Berkeley has, depending on your major, it has either a clear path as to where to get started in a career as a musician. It was fairly clear for me coming from MPNE, because it was just, you know, go to a city where there are major recording studios and try to get an internship or try to get a job there, you know?
Right.
And that's basically what I did. I was gonna go to Berlin, because, an acquaintance that I knew through a professor had a job at a really cool studio there, and she was returning to Mexico. And so there was an opening there. But on my way there, my girlfriend at the time lived in Miami. So I came to Miami to visit her for a couple weeks, and I ended up getting hired at the Hit Factory here.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. 305 Criteria Recording Studios, the Hit Factory. It has like a dual name, but that's basically what happened.
Well, worked out nicely for your girlfriend. I'm sure she was happy about that.
Yeah, and she's still happy about that because we got married last year. So.
Oh, yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, so cool. It's right after Berkeley. MPD was one of your majors. You go down and land a job at a very good studio. This sounds like you and I should not be having this conversation right now, right? You're on this.
Yeah. I didn't last too long at that studio. I was very good doing my job. The job was very tough.
An assistant engineer, I assume?
Yeah, I was an assistant engineer, which being an assistant engineer in 2017, late 2017, already looked very different than what I imagine it looks now, but it was already not what I was expecting it to be. I was basically just a runner. And, you know, I would come in to the room to set it up for a session. Setting up the room consisted in putting up a couple mics that were going to get tried out for a recording session for very famous people. And at some point, the producer would come in and just use two channels out of our ginormous solid state logic board that had like 100 channels. They would use two channels, two more channels for the microphones. And on an exciting day, we would pull out a pull deck or a TLA or something like that. And then I would have to wire up, you know, a couple compressors and an EQ. And then that was it. I would just sit down until somebody showed up and they wanted Burger King, or Starbucks or whatever it was. And I got paid $7 an hour, which isn't even legal, I think.
I was going to say, I mean, well, minimum wage is currently $7.25, but that sounds, maybe it was $7 back then, or maybe they were shaving a quarter.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were. Florida is very lax with labor laws, so there's that. And then the hours were just crazy. I would have to come in sometimes at 2 in the morning and leave the next day at 7 p.m. And then come back in later that night again. So essentially it was like I get out of the studio, go home, take a shower, take a nap, regardless of whether it's like 5 p.m. or 4 a.m., and then do it all over again.
You're not the first person who told me about this type of studio experience.
And I am sure I haven't been the first person. Yeah.
Yes, it does not sound like fun. So how long were you there?
I was there for 4 months.
All right. That's about as long as I lasted teaching high school.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. So that was about 4 months. I was also, you know, trying to exercise my other major, which it was performance. So I was already getting gigs, getting paid way more money on even like a per hour calculation, to do wedding gigs and such. But the moment where I decided to sort of quit the studio was I got a gig to as a substitute guitar player for this artist called Austin Mahone.
Okay.
He used to be kind of big, but when we did these shows, they weren't so big, but it was still a lot of money for me. It was a great day rate. And I literally couldn't do both. So the decision was pretty obvious for me at that point.
Right. Hundreds of dollars for playing alongside someone versus seven an hour.
Correct. Yeah. I made like, even during the rehearsal weeks with him, I made more money than I had made in like 2 months working at the Hit Factory.
Yeah, that's, hey, I teach economics, to be a fool to not take that opportunity.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I mean, cool. So you're doing music now and being the sideman for that band. I mean, that's great. How long does that go for?
Yeah, so my gigs with him were very short. Like I said, I was only a sub, but that opened the door for a very consistent stream of gigs locally in wedding bands and basically just corporate bands. I got a part-time job teaching guitar lessons, which paid me a great hourly rate. And they had benefits, and all in all, it was great for me. I could take care of the basics sort of with those teaching hours. Mm-hmm. And then I was at the time also doing fly dates with a couple of different artists. So I grew up in Venezuela, in Latin America.
You were doing what?
I was doing fly dates. Yeah.
Does that
so,
mean like where you fly somewhere to play a gig?
Yeah, it means you're – I kind of have a pet peeve when people say they go on tour and it's just like you go and do three shows in Mexico. You're not really on tour. You just went and did three shows in Mexico, you know?
Okay, yeah, fair.
So I was doing fly dates with a couple of different people. I grew up in Venezuela, so I had sort of connections with the Latin scene and the Latin alternative scene. I never really got into like the mainstream – reggaeton and all of that, but I did play with a lot of sort of major to medium level Latin American acts. And so I was, for the majority of my full-time professional musician career, I was doing like 60 to 80 shows per year and then also teaching on the side.
That seems like a good number.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so I mean that plus teaching. I mean that sounds like you're doing great. So once again, We wouldn't be having this conversation if you were still doing it. So what was the next fork in the road?
Yeah. So then we, you know, we know what happened. There was a pandemic, global pandemic, hit in 2020.
Yep.
That definitely put a hard stop to all the touring. And I went, I had been sort of producing on a limited basis while I was doing all of those other things. I also have my own project, my solo project, which wasn't doing terribly. It also wasn't doing fantastically, but I was getting some shows and getting a little bit of revenue from royalties, enough to keep the project going, essentially. And that allowed me sort of like the digital success of having been in Spotify playlists and whatnot gave me enough leverage or credibility to get clients as a producer. So during the pandemic, I basically spent the entire year just teaching, still teaching remotely, mm-hmm. but the income that I needed from playing gigs, I was essentially receiving from touring.
Touring or from production? From
production, sorry. Yep. And then by the end of the pandemic comes what I would call as like the final stretch of my full-time musician career. I got hired to be the guitarist in a very prominent sort of legacy band from Venezuela.
Okay.
And I spent 2022 and the majority of 2023 basically permanently on tour.
Okay. Wow. I mean, if the money's good, if you're playing a lot of shows, make a good amount per show, it's a good living. Although it sounds like you're with your, that's around the time you're getting married. So maybe the touring lifestyle didn't have as much appeal to you.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. I think that I was making enough money to live, but it was never, I never got the impression that the amount of money that I was making was consistent with the amount of work that I needed to output to receive said amount of money.
Sure.
So it was, I was always feeling like I am underpaid, essentially, no matter what. And, you know, like I've mentioned, most of my touring career was with acts that were in Latin America. So the rates are definitely not as good as rates that you would see in the United States. Just
right.
To be
people
fully
less
transparent.
Money in general.
Yeah, exactly. So to be fully transparent, I made $570 per show in certain territories and $400 in other shows on most territories that weren't like the primary territories for the band. However, the main...
I was going to say, if you're doing five shows a week, even 400 a show is six figures.
Yeah, but I wasn't doing five shows a week. The problem, like if you do the math, I was doing around 100 shows per year. So that even at the good rate, that's like 60K. And the main pain point was if you nowadays... I still have a lot of friends that tour full time with large acts and even medium tiered acts, I would say. Most of these people that are touring through with, I would say, US based artists also have income the days that are they're traveling and for rehearsals, whereas I would only get paid for a show. And then the logistics of touring with a Latin American band are very prohibitive in the way that you can't really do too many shows because of distance. So we would have, let's say, a regular week for us would be, I would fly out on a Wednesday to Mexico City to do a show on Thursday. And then on Friday, I would fly to, I don't know, Miami to do a show on Friday. And then I would fly to Tijuana on Saturday morning to do a show on Saturday, and we would do just three shows that week, essentially.
And a lot of travel.
A lot of travel, yeah. A lot of travel. No bus. And I think you know where it's going. Like, the primary factor, at least for me, and the decision to pivot away was more of a lifestyle reality than it was a monetary reality, at least for me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I understand. You're like, yeah, the pay is keeping you going, but it's not great, and the time mm-hmm. commitment is extreme.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, granted, in that band, every single band member except for the singer lives in Mexico. So if you live in Mexico and you're making around $50,000 to $60,000 a year, you're essentially very high middle class.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, at least in 2024, not so much anymore.
Yeah. Cool. So, like, at what point did you think, okay, yeah, this isn't sustainable, I need to do something else?
Yeah. So there were several of those moments, but I was playing the last show of 2022, sorry. Mm-hmm. It was December 22nd. I had already that year, like, missed, you know, it had been years where I've been missing birthdays, Thanksgiving, holidays, whatnot. And so to cut costs, I didn't say where we were playing. We were playing in Mexicali, which is the brother town of Calexico, which is a border town between California and Mexico.
Okay.
We were playing in Mexicali, and to cut costs, I had to, going back home instead of just getting to the nearest city and having a direct flight to Miami to go home for Christmas, I had to cross the border on foot, take a cab, and then go to the Calexico side, so the United States side, airport, where I flew on a very small airplane to the LA airport, from which I took an airplane to Dallas-Fort Worth, and then from there I flew to Miami. It was like 22 hours of travel to come home, and that was one of many such opportunities, you know. And then you're like, I just did this whole thing and I got paid like $500, and I'm literally destroyed. You know, I was starting to see some negative effects in terms of my health, my physical health, as well as a little bit of my mental health. And my girlfriend and I did not want to move to Mexico to basically live more comfortably. So I started realizing that I had to pivot, either I would say horizontally, which would mean like pivot within the music industry, or, you know, take a ginormous risk and pursue something different.
Sure. So, yeah. So what happens next? We're into 2023 now.
Yeah. So, in that moment, I, tried to be methodical, and I conducted a series of informal interviews with other friends that were working in different areas of the music industry. Mm-hmm. I talked to, obviously, the majority of my experience was touring. So I contacted a few friends that are MDs in the LA area, and they work with major acts.
MD?
A music director.
Got it.
Yeah. So I talked to a couple of them, and I had some good opportunities flung my way. They all made a lot of sense financially. So, I may not have the latest numbers, but this is very close to what's factual right now. So if you want to be a touring musician with an act that is large. So let's say something like Charlie Puth or someone like Carol G, you know, good friend Valeria Falcón, probably everybody in Berkeley knows her right now. She used to play bass in my band at Berkeley for my senior recital and whatnot. She's currently touring with Carol G. She's toured with Harry Styles and a bunch of other people. I've gotten these numbers from her. So basically, you can expect to make around $750 per day. And sometimes you get a full rate on travel days if the artist is big enough. And worst case scenario, you get half of that on a non-travel date. So if you're touring, I don't know, 10 months out of the year, you're definitely clearing six figures.
Right.
But you still have to be comfortable with the lifestyle, which at that point, I didn't know if I was. So I got an offer to go play for an artist. Sometimes these offers, you don't know who the artist is until you start rehearsals. So I got an offer, basically. It was those same numbers that I just mentioned. It was $750 per show, half of that on a travel day. But it was going to be a 48-week tour, and I didn't really want to commit to that. So I talked to other friends who also were – I have friends that are in film scoring and other areas, and where they don't have to travel as much, the lifestyle is still – very oppressive. You have strange hours. Some of them have kids and they don't see them much. You don't really have anything like PTO. You don't really have insurance. You don't have 401k. You just are a contractor. Even if you make a lot of money, you're still a contractor and you're subject to all of these very arbitrary realities that come along with the music industry. So, yeah, after meeting, I at that point I had gone to LA for a month to talk to friends and see what I could do. Mm-hmm. After not being satisfied with any of my findings, I called up my cousin who works at Google, and he suggested that I could try coding if I liked it, and do a boot camp, which is basically a very intensive course where you learn the basics of a certain area of software development with the hopes of getting a job. And so that's
which boot camps did you do?
I went to a boot camp called Hack Reactor. It's under Galvanize. And I was honestly very happy with my experience.
All right. That's good to know. Quick question. Did you do much in the way of studying coding before you did the boot camp, or did you go from zero to boot camp?
Oh, yeah. I had been learning, self-learning through several websites and courses by myself, let's say like 4 to 6 months before I made that decision. So it wasn't definitely a brash decision. It was something that had been in the back of my mind for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I had also done other studies. Like I took a economics course through Harvard Online. I took a accounting course and statistics, whatnot. So I had been studying several different programming languages. I had done small projects. So I did go with some experience, but some of the people that go into those programs are very advanced programmers. Some of them have even gone through a computer science degree, and they just don't know how to actually code.
So can I just get the order straight? Did it go conversation with the cousin, 4 to 6 months on your own boot camp, or did it go 4 to 6 months on your own conversation with the cousin boot camp?
That would be the correct order. So 4 to 6 months on my own, conversation, boot camp.
Yeah, boot camp's what, like a 3 or 4 month thing?
It was a 3 month boot camp. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And after that, I went straight on to work as a contractor. Simultaneously, so part-time with the company where I did the boot camp and part-time for a startup.
How did you get that position with the startup?
I was honestly very, very lucky. I have a very close friend from the infancy who studied mathematics and computer science, and he had been a software engineer at Google for a number of years at that point, and he had just quit to start a company, and he received a lot of capital. And so he wasn't able to take me on as an engineer because I definitely did not meet the requirements, but he did bring me on as an intern first and then as a contractor, and I did some work for him.
Cool. And so, by the way, when did you finish the boot camp?
I finished the boot camp in June of last year.
2023.
Correct, yeah.
Cool. So then how long are you doing this part-time for the boot camp, part-time for your friend?
I did that until January of 2024.
And let me guess, were you just like applying for better like full-time positions and this one hit, or?
I was, yeah, and it was very, very, very difficult to get a position, especially in the current market. It was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life.
Really? Well, how many applications did you send out before one hit?
I can tell you the exact number because I have it. I have data for all of that process, so I sent out 1,412 applications.
Wow, that might be a record.
Oh, yeah? It was definitely one of the worst times that you could have attempted what I was attempting.
Now, it's funny that you're saying that because, I mean, the unemployment rate in 2023 and 2024 is quite low in general.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think a worse time to find a job, I think 2009 or 2010 or even, you know, 2000 during COVID.
But, yeah.
You know, what made this such a terrible time?
So you are right in the sense that unemployment rate's very low, but the tech market itself is not in a, or the software engineer market is not in a hot or in a, let's say a buyer's market right now.
Okay.
So you had at the very early beginnings of 2023, a lot of layoffs from major companies. And all of those companies laid off a lot of engineers. So now you have the job market is flooded with very competent people that have a lot of experience under their belts and they have degrees. And you are somebody who just graduated from a coding bootcamp with no experience and no degree.
Got it. Yeah, I can see where that would be tough.
Yeah. So I did get very far in a lot of processes. Fortunately, software is in a way democratic where it's like a lot of these processes are technical interviews where if you solve problems and you score high, it automatically keeps moving you forward. But if you reach the final stage of an interview and there's four candidates and they all scored about the same and one has a degree from Stanford and the other one doesn't, then, you know, who the job's going to?
Right. You're constantly the second choice, I'd say, right? Second choice comes with a salary of zero.
Correct, yeah.
Cool. And then this one, it just one finally hit? Like there wasn't a special connection or anything?
No, and that was kind of funny because I had 2 months before that happened, I had pivoted my strategy, my job search strategy, to be like a people-centric strategy where I was trying to connect in a very non-interested way with professionals in the industry. And if it happened to be where they were hiring and they thought that I could be a potential candidate, they would generally offer to prefer me. And that had been giving way better results. I was at that time in final rounds with Pinterest and Geico, but this company started interviewing me, and they just had at least for me, a better or more attractive sort of offer.
Got it. Oh, by the way, I don't think I asked earlier, do you work from home or hybrid or in the office?
I do work fully remote, and that was the selling point for me to take this job.
Gotcha. And were you hired into your position, or were you hired at level one and then promoted?
No, I did get hired directly into this position. So apparently my experience as a contractor had, you know, given me enough credibility to be a developer too, I guess.
Awesome.
Yeah. So. Well, and now that I think about it, I haven't really reminisced about this, but the job posting was for a developer one, but when I started, that was not the title they gave me. So I guess they just factored in my experience or something.
Oh, well, that's terrific.
Yeah.
I'm thinking one time with my wife where the opposite happens, where they were, you know, advertised this like senior level role. She was definitely senior level, and, you know, a salary that went with that. And then like the interviews all went well and they made her an offer. And when they made her an offer, they're like, oh, by the way, our HR department made an error. It's not a senior position and the pay is $20,000 less.
Oh, no. That is definitely terrible.
It's like, no, and thank you so much for wasting my time.
Right, yeah, yeah. I assume she did not accept that position,
No, she most definitely did not.
Yeah, that checks out. I would also not do that.
Yeah. All right, great. So let's move on to the third part of the interview of three.
Yeah.
So I'll preface this next question with there is no right or wrong answer.
Mm-hmm.
So these days, and let's define these days as like spring, summer, early fall 2024.
Yeah.
What, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
Yeah. So I remember one of the points you asked when we were setting up this interview, it being very clear that I couldn't be a full-time musician or had to account to a percentage of my income. So my relationship with music, I will say, is still very active. It's still a major part of my life, and I am still, for all intents and purposes, a professional musician because I get paid to do it. I just do it in a lesser capacity. So I still play shows with one of the artists that I played with in Latin America, who is a very close friend, and it's very enjoyable for me to be a part of his project. I am his music director. We do about 20 shows a year, and most of the time I'm able to take my work with me. It doesn't interfere. So I can go to, you know, New York, take my computer, write code during the day, and then at 5 o'clock go to soundcheck and play a show.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. All right, great. And, next question I have for you is, right, you got a degree from Berkeley. You did music for a while, and frankly, you chose to leave. I'm not going to say you were pushed out, right? You even talk about having this opportunity to do a year-long tour at a very good rate. And
yeah.
You just said, okay, cool, but I don't think that's, you know, I want to see my wife a little more than that.
So.
You know, Berkeley definitely prepared you for what you're doing now, but let's say people come into coding from many different angles.
Mm-hmm.
And relative to if you'd gone some other undergrad, you'd gone to University of Florida or something, is there anything you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now working as a software engineer?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's very common for people to view Berkeley in a negative light, and especially afterward, you know. But I wouldn't be the person that I am today if I hadn't gone through it. And I don't think it's necessarily what Berkeley does to people, but it is what people do with Berkeley and what people do at Berkeley. And I think that's one of the things that's so important about the type of community that goes to that school. That was at least my experience. So it, I know I'm putting in very vague terms, but in a more concrete way, at least when I went to Berkeley, I went from 2013 to 2017. Mm-hmm. That was a big transitional period for the university. I was merging with Boston Conservatory, yep, and then with New England Conservatory.
I'm going to do a minor correction.
We
have a merge with New England Conservatory.
Oh, it,
we
it
merged
didn't.
With BOCO.
Right. We merged with BOCO. Why did I think it was merging with NEC?
I don't know, man. I mean, we've had a couple other new things happen. Like, you know, they opened a satellite campus in Abu Dhabi and the Valencia campus. Expanded a lot.
I'm crazy then. My bad. Well, we did merge with BOCO, and that was a process. And then Roger Brown's presidency came to an end, right? At that event,
He left in 2020. He was going to leave, I think, in early 2020. Actually, he left 2021. It was like he was going to leave summer 2020, and then the pandemic hit, and he's like, I'll stay one more year.
Got it. Yeah. But in any case, I did get the transitional feeling, right? I may be mistaken about, you know, we look at the past in a very imagined way, I think. But in any case, you know, I'm a first-generation immigrant, and my mindset going into Berkeley was I'm going to go there, become the best person that I can and the best musician that I can. So I learned a very dedicated and very thorough work ethic that I think it's difficult to find in other places. When people go to Berkeley, they very quickly learn how difficult it is to get really good at something. And I don't mean just good. I mean like really, really good at something. And that's something that you don't really learn in a lot of places. And then the other factor at Berkeley too is it's a magnet for the best kids all over the globe at their instruments, at their craft. So you would constantly be exposed to people that are almost unbelievable to see in first person. I would have to pinch myself all the time and ask myself, is this person actually doing what I think they're doing right in front of me? And that would motivate me to not just try harder, but also think deeper about what I was doing, about why I was doing things. And again, you know, when you meet people in the corporate world and everyday aspects of life, it's very hard to find that beautiful spark that people at Berkeley have. So I am extremely grateful for my experience there.
Got it. Great. So let's turn that question around now.
Yeah.
Because Berkeley gives that one degree, the Bachelor's in Music. You went there knowing that. You did music for a while. You're now doing very well for yourself. But all that said, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, you know, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing and complete?
Well, okay, yeah, so that's a great question. I think that it would be awesome if somehow the Department of Music Production and Engineering had a track where you can actually study engineering, like electronic engineering, or you could even study digital signal processing and study computer science through the lens of music, because very few schools actually prepare people to do that. And then you can go and be like literally a person that works at Isotope or Neural DSP or any of these companies that are building amazing software for pedals and plugins and things that are extremely well paid. And I don't know, we could definitely be doing something there.
Cool. Just FYI, it's not a major, but I want to say it was maybe 4 years ago. Could be five. Berkeley actually does now have like digital instrument option as a principal instrument.
Oh wow, that is very cool. I do mean though specifically like being able to grant a BS in electrical engineering with a concentration in something like digital signal processing or audio equipment.
I see what you mean.
Something like that. Yeah.
Got it. Okay, cool. So next question I have for you is, again, you did music for a while, then you got to the feeling like, I don't really want to keep doing this for the rest of my life in the way you were doing it, right? I may have phrased that badly. You were thinking, I don't want to do this as my one thing for the rest of my life. And then you pivoted very successfully. There are other people out there who also, other Berkeley grads who might be getting that same feeling to what you were feeling before you pivoted, and also like the current group of Berkeley students who's staring out at the big scary world wondering what comes next. So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
I would say that being a Berkeley grad is definitely an advantage. And I would also say that, I know it sounds cliche, but anything that you can imagine is definitely feasible. If you want to go and be a doctor, you can definitely do that. It's going to take work, just like getting good at your instrument took work.
All right, very cool. And to zoom in a little bit, I think you're my 251st interview. No one's listening to all 251, but you're one of, I think, about 15 software engineers.
Oh, wow.
Anyone who's made it this far is interested in software engineering. So for someone who's not doing it yet, but thinking hard about that as a career option, what specific advice do you have for them?
What specific advice? I would say consider the market, consider what you want to do, and try, if you go through a basics course and you build a project to learn a little bit about it and you don't enjoy it a lot, don't do it. Because it's going to be a lot of that, I think you just have to be able to become as obsessed as you were about music or your instrument for it to be a feasible path. Especially in this market. If it were a different market right now, I would say just go for it.
Right. No, that's good. I'll tell you a little